Welcome to Smoke and Science, the podcast where the deeper we go, we realize the less we know. Cannabis is an example of a natural product that has been used by cultures for specific therapeutic purposes for thousands of years. But there are many different plants that are used as medicine throughout the world and many people who study the therapeutic potential of these plants. On this episode, we have Dr. Cassandra Quave. Dr. Quave is an ethnobotanist, associate professor, writer, podcast host, mother, explorer, and overall awesome person. We're stoked to talk with her today, not only about our favorite plant, but also the many others that have contributed to the healing across the world.
We are so excited to have you here, Dr. Quave, on the podcast. And how I was first introduced to your work and your lab was that Riley told me that you were one of our only scientist crushes. And so I knew that I was just going to love you and love your work. And so excited to talk to you about natural products and chemodiversity and the chemistry that is in nature.
Well, I'm super excited to be here with two amazing women communicating science. So this is going to be fun.
Yeah. And for all the listeners, Dr. Quave and I are both part of what we call ASP, or the American Society of Pharmacognosy. A lot of people haven't heard of the word pharmacognosy, but it essentially means the discovery of new drugs or medicinal compounds isolated from nature. So typically bacteria, fungi, and plants. So I listened to Dr. Quave talk at a few ASP meetings, and I was really impressed with the ethnobotanical approach to natural product chemistry and the connection with the plants and the community among where she collected the plants. So it's something that's always impressed me.
Yeah, so I'm wondering, since I have less information about your background and about your research, like, why natural products for you? And, you know, is this something like you've been interested in since you were a kid? Or how did you get into your field of studying chemistry of natural products?
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, I grew up in South Florida in this little rural town, and I spent a lot of time outdoors. And I was actually making medicines as a kid, you know, pounding up oozy, kind of slimy aloe leaves with like ash and weird plants I'd find around the yard to make my medicine that I'd rub all over my little sister. But yeah, I've just always been fascinated with medicine in general. And it was really in college that I first learned about the field of ethnobotany, which is the scientific study of how people relate with plants. And I was really fortunate. I was able to take a trip to the Amazon as a rising senior in college, and really got to see firsthand how important wild plants are to medicine in a different culture. And I've just never stopped since then studying those plants.
That sounds like such an amazing experience, especially at such a young age, to be able to go into the Amazon and experiment and learn from these different medicinal plants and the traditional ways that they've been prepared and used by the communities. So something I think that would be really interesting to discuss on this podcast, because it's something that's kind of ingrained in the natural product chemistry community, is talking about ways that we can utilize and benefit from these traditional medicines and from these communities without exploiting the people of that community, and also ensuring that we have a sustainable way of harvesting and utilizing this medicine.
There's a big difference between what's known as biopiracy, and that's the theft of indigenous knowledge, the theft of genetic resources, and bioprospecting, which is the search for natural products, things that could be potentially useful both to medicine, but also other fields of industry. And the main difference between the two is really that bioprospecting is something that's done under the umbrella of ethical engagement with communities. And this is something that we really take very seriously in my research group. So we do work at the community level with different cultures in countries around the globe, but we also work closely with local scientists. And so a lot of what we do is first determine what do communities want back from the collaboration? How can they benefit from scientific research? In many cases, healers often want to have the laboratory results that we find return to them so that they can better understand how their medicines work. We also work closely with scientists to help build up their research capacity. In some of the world's global, you know, terrestrial biodiversity hotspots, you have such amazing richness in diversity of plants, diversity of life, and of chemistry. And yet those also happen to be the places oftentimes where local scientists don't have access to the types of tools and equipment that we do here in the US. So we do a lot to also build up research capacity. All of this kind of falls under the premises of the Nagoya Protocol on access and benefit sharing. And so, you know, you place agreements to come to agreements on how to share things should there be financial gains in the future. But we really start from the beginning by ensuring that communities are getting what they need, even if no money or no kind of economically viable path emerges from such a project.
I think that's so important, too, because another aspect of this by engaging the community that you ensure is a sustainability, because there's another problem that can arise from, you know, a natural product being discovered and being used is the oversourcing of that product to the detriment of, you know, the communities that use it and then to us and to the world, because you're mentioning biodiversity, the large number of living things that are present in forests and that produce these amazing compounds that we study, that's a gift. And to get rid of that or to, you know, it's at risk, basically. And I think that that's something that is really, really important that I think it's amazing that you're doing, that you're establishing a way in which to do it ethically.
Yeah. And I mean, and to be clear, like our work is very much on the science discovery side. When it gets into the area or the space of commercialization, that's a whole other box to unpack, because that's where sustainability really becomes important. And there are good examples of companies that have worked closely with communities to ensure that the medicinal plants are being harvested sustainably. A good example of this is a drug called crofelemer. It's marketed as Mytesi, and it's actually from the dragon's blood plant that comes from the Amazonian rainforest. And that company has worked very closely with communities to ensure that they have means of sustainable harvest and equitable pay for those that grow these species. But, you know, there still are a lot of problems. I do a lot of work in the Balkans, and, you know, you have very high volumes of wild harvested medicinal plants that enter into the multi-billion-dollar supplement trade that we have globally. It's especially big in the US and in Europe. And I believe in the past year, we had something like 17% growth in this space. So there's a lot of money changing hands in this market. Yet on the ground level, when you're looking at the people that are actually wildcrafting and collecting these, they're paid very, very little. And it's often children that are off collecting these plants. And guess what? They can mistake species. And so some of the work that we're doing in the Balkans with students, again, from universities located there, is really to try and better understand which species are actually entering into trade and what are the implications when you have mix-ups of species, especially of any threatened endemic species.
Right. And the adulteration of supplements and natural products is quite common. And the FDA is trying to work on that as well, of regulating and finding new ways to immediately identify if a supplement is adulterated. I mean, think if you had a field of St. John's wort or something, and then there was a couple Datura species in there that were just, you know, living their life, you know, and someone just went and harvested that whole field. Well, they definitely have some Datura in there. And then if they make that into supplements, people start getting sick and they say, oh my gosh, we need to find out immediately what the issue is. A lot of times they use sequencing to try to figure out exactly what that contaminant is. So it's really important to have those DNA libraries, to have plant extract libraries, ways of quickly identifying adulterants.
Yeah. And I think we have to go beyond just the chemistry and the genetic studies of products when they're much further down the development chain. I guess my perspective as an ethnobotanist is that the industry can do more to work with local communities directly, because often these plants are being exchanged through middlemen and then like the regional level and then the country level. And the people that are actually trying to make a living off of this, that are out there identifying the species, sometimes correctly, sometimes incorrectly, they're just trying to make a living wage. And so I think we can do a lot by ensuring greater sustainability, you know, greater accuracy in plant collections if we just connected better with those communities.
Yeah, I love this perspective. And it's kind of the same concept as preventative medicine and the benefits of that. Before we get too far into this episode, I'd love to discuss secondary metabolites and what they are and what they do, because we've talked about secondary metabolites before in the realm of cannabis, and we often kind of go to CBD or THC when describing what a secondary metabolite is. But every single plant is making these unique compounds that they use for their defense. And we then also use these molecules as medicine. They're very active in our bodies often as well. So I'd love to hear how you define and describe secondary metabolites to people, because, you know, different plants have different biodiversity in their region. They have different stressors from the environment, and that's going to cause them to produce unique chemistry and potentially unique medicine.
So I think the most important thing to remember is that plants are sessile, right? They can't run away from a threat. They can't go towards things necessarily that they need or want. And so secondary metabolites are all the chemicals that plants produce that are produced for purposes other than just basic growth and survival. So these are their, you can think of it as like the chemical language of plants. And I can give you an example of something that as humans we engage with secondary metabolites. So if you think about the odor and color of a rose, there are secondary metabolites that make the rose that beautiful, brilliant red color. And there are other metabolites that yield that amazing fragrant, you know, aroma of a rose. Now, if you think about the aroma of a rose compared to that of like a corpse plant, I don't know if you guys have ever seen one of those in botanic gardens, right? So they're they kind of smell it's the Titan arum, you know, these are originate in Indonesia. And when they're in full bloom, it smells like, you know, just a rotting dead carcass. Now, why would a rose smell like a rose and this other plant decide I'm going to smell like a rotting dead carcass? It all comes down to the types of organisms they're trying to attract to themselves. So one attracts, you know, pollinators that like that rose scent, whereas the other attracts pollinators that like the scent of dead or rotting flesh. And so it's just, you know, plants are just amazing chemical engineers, and all those secondary metabolites are really how they engage with the world.
So I come from a background of pharmacology. Like I was doing target evaluation stuff. So like endogenous systems, like the endocannabinoid system. And I've always just thought this, I'm wondering what you think about this. What about humans having secondary metabolites? Like what about, like we are incredibly complicated. What do you think about that?
Well, I mean, we certainly have, you know, our own kind of odors, although those are really microbial metabolites when you think about it. Because, you know, if
some
you think
of us
about,
have more odors than others.
Yeah. But I'm like, how much of your secondary metabolite profile is due to human cells versus microbial cells? I mean, we are literally coated with microbes. So I don't know how easy it is to tease that apart.
What about like skin melanin? That's something I've been kind of thinking of. Like it protects the skin, right? In different mm-hmm. ways. But I guess it's a little more complex than just simply a secondary metabolite, but it's kind of there.
Not essential. What about like, what about trace minerals like manganese or like, I don't know. I'm just like.
I guess when I think of like secondary metabolites, I tend to think of them more as like small molecule, like organic, you know, natural products is, and so not so much in the mineral domain. But yeah, I mean, we definitely release different signals into the environment. I mean, that's an interesting area of science. We need to do some more like, you know, volatile organic compound sensing on humans to see what pops up.
When we think of secondary metabolites in plants, we might think that maybe they produce one compound to help against bacteria and one compound to help against fungi, etc. But realistically, they're producing thousands of different mm-hmm. compounds with different molecular structures that are extremely diverse. And then you are looking for activity against a specific target. Say you're looking for like an anti-cancer drug. You would look for to see if one of those compounds is active against that cancer cell line. This can get really, really complicated when we have these thousands of different molecules present. Does your lab produce a extract library to increase your chances of getting a hit on some sort of assay? Or how does your lab go about kind of figuring out what's active and what's not active from all these different plants?
Yeah, that's such a great question. So we start with our field work, where we work with communities to identify which plants have some utility in treating infectious and inflammatory disease. We then take those species and the parts of those species. So again, the tissues of the plant are also really important. So the leaves may be used, but the roots not, right? Or vice versa. So we take those parts back to the lab and we create what are known as crude extracts. And so any of the listeners are familiar with crude extracts. If you ever make like a drip coffee in the morning, or you make a cup of tea and you have that clear solvent, your hot water that passes through this plant material, that's an extraction. We just do it in the lab with a little bit more complexity. We have equipment that can basically remove all the water, and then you're left with this kind of crystalline gunky stuff. That's the plant's chemistry, right? And so we have created a library of over 700 species, and we have around 2,500 extracts now. And we most definitely use that for kind of drug discovery screening platforms. So we our standard pathway right now is where we extract by hot water. So as a decoction, where we basically boil this in water for 20 minutes. And the other method we use is an organic extraction, aqueous organics. We just soak it in 80% ethanol for a few days and kind of macerate that and then dry it down. The reason we stick with those types of solvents is that these are the two most common means that traditional medicines are prepared. And so we try and stick with like the ways that they're prepared. There are cases though where plants are extracted in oil, you know, in fleurage, which I love how that sounds. In fleurage, it just means like in fats. but like we also will prepare it in that way if it's indicated according to traditional practice. Yeah. And so we test those. We have this really cool robot that can take little aliquots, so little raindrop size drops of the material that we're testing against along with the extract into these little tiny wells. So you can think of like a small dish that has 384 tiny test tubes. We load all that liquid together and we, you know, incubate it. Sometimes we have to measure fluorescence or luminescence or optical density. So we're looking for basically light measurements based on the different tools that we're using. And then we look for things that we would consider a preliminary hit. And that's just the beginning of the story because, you know, as you mentioned, each plant tissue has thousands of unique molecules. So basically in those tiny little test tubes, we're finding a haystack. And so we say, okay, well, we have three haystacks. Look interesting. Now we have to go and find the needles in that haystack.
Yeah. So for our listeners, crude extracts, like one of the most common ones is RSO or Rick Simpson's oil, is an ethanol extract of cannabis that is crude, which means it just, you know, it just contains everything in it. And then, you know, you remove a good amount of the ethanol. You know, the entourage effect is regularly thrown around in the cannabis industry as this effect that is caused by this combination of all the things in the plants. Secondary metabolites, as we were mentioning earlier, contain cannabinoids, terpenes, but there's so much more than that. There are hundreds and hundreds of molecules in the plant. And there is some evidence qualitatively and a few peer-reviewed publications out there that, you know, discuss this entourage effect and how it's different. And I think like from my perspective, it makes sense that there is possibly more than one active thing, right? Do you regularly see that in other plants that you study as well, that maybe like in one fraction, there'll be more than one active component?
Oh yeah, absolutely. I mean, you have to realize plants don't produce these compounds as like from A and then you have Z in their biosynthetic pathway. You have A and you have B, C, D, E, F, G of all these structurally similar compounds that are coming off this biosynthetic pathway along the way that's being made. And I think it's, you know, it's key that nature doesn't work with kind of single compound, single target mechanisms. Nature works through a very complex mixture of these compounds. Here's another simple example that some of your listeners might be familiar with. If you've ever compared the flavor of artificial vanilla extract to an actual vanilla pod extract that has the little orchid pod in it, if you just compare the flavors of those, your artificial vanilla, which is made, by the way, out of kind of a wood pulp extraction process, right? This vanillin, which is the principal compound there. Vanillin smells very much like vanilla, but when you smell it or taste it, it's lacking that full body of a real vanilla extract, right? And that's really the difference between a single compound and the difference between a group of compounds acting on your receptors in your nose and in your mouth as you're sensing that plant. So yeah, I think multiple compounds are very important to a lot of activities of medicinal plants. And we've seen this also, you know, if you think about therapies for malaria, artemisinin is a compound that was pulled out of the wormwood plant from China. A Nobel Prize was awarded for that discovery, by the way. And that's a plant that's been used for thousands of years to treat malaria successfully. We pulled out the single compound, developed it into a drug, and have used that widely. Now you have widespread artemisinin resistance. Other follow-up studies have shown that when you look at the complex plant, the complex profile of secondary metabolites, you can restore activity against these resistant strains. And so, like, it goes back to that necessity of having all the components in some cases to yield the desired effect.
Miyabi and I talk about this all the time. We call it nature's redundancy, and how there's so many different molecules that the plants make and other natural organisms produce. And it really is due to these different biosynthetic pathways that are used to make them, and how it's just nothing's ever linear. So I also studied and developed a medicinal plant extract library during my graduate work, and also used traditional methods of extraction, essentially making teas and tinctures to understand what the active compounds were in these different natural products. And what really amazed me time and time again was, as you start to isolate the active compounds from these organisms, it's almost never just one compound that has activity. It's typically like a group of molecules that have some activity, and one is just the most potent of all of them. So when we were analyzing the different plant extracts against different bacterial pathogens, what we were finding is either the crude extract or like the active fraction. So it's not crude, but it still has dozens of different molecules present. Those fractions, the bacteria would take longer to develop resistance to that active compound compared to if it was a pure molecule, so one single compound. And if you think of this kind of like an obstacle course, if you're exposing those bacteria to one single pure compound molecule, like a drug, that bacteria, it is presented with an obstacle, but if one in a million of those bacteria cells are able to complete that obstacle, that bacteria could recolonate and recause an infection. However, if you had dozens of different active molecules present in that plant extract, that plant fraction, you're now expanding that obstacle course. So instead of just getting over one difficult obstacle, it needs to get over dozens of obstacles. And this is going to take the bacteria longer, if it's even possible, to develop resistance, because they're not all acting in the same way. So the bacteria need to learn how to combat these different active molecules if they're even able to.
Right. Or potentially, because you have this synergy between like a large number of compounds at a lower level or like a lower dose, a lot of this resistance is developed because the bacteria and are there any resistance? This is how tolerance works in cannabis too, like why you need to start taking more and more. That develops when you're oversaturating with one single thing, because our bodies and the bacteria are able to like overcome that when they have an abundance of that one thing to interact with. So I've always thought it's also a piece of it that if you had these extracts with a large number of things that are, yes, maybe weaker and less potent, there's more of them together working in different pathways, and also that there's not enough of any single one of them to develop like a resistant pathway, because you actually need that, you need that over and over and over again for, I mean, basically resistance is when they are evolving in front of our eyes. They are evolving to beat us.
Basically. Yeah. Well, this is another super cool thing that I've really gleaned from my years of interacting with traditional healers, is like when it comes to infectious disease, and that's like really my jam. I'm all about like oozing pustulant wounds. That's what I like to study. Oh, and how to really like find solutions for those. Very sexy, I know. But like what I've learned from a lot of traditional healers is their mindset is not set in the Western mindset that we have about just killing an infection, that we have to obliterate the infection. When they talk about disease, it's more about restoring balance to the body. And so that's kind of a philosophy of medicine. What does that mean to restore balance? And what's been really fascinating to me is in the laboratory, we've seen that there are plants that are used in traditional medicine specifically to treat infection, but yet don't really inhibit the growth of bacteria and don't kill bacteria. And so in the past, those types of plants, if studied by a scientist only looking for things that act like a regular antibiotic that just kill or slow down the growth, those would have been tossed out as like an old wives' tale. Oh, well, that doesn't work. I mean, if it doesn't work like penicillin does, then it's not useful. But actually what we're finding instead is that some of these compounds work by disabling or disarming the ability of bacteria to cause harm to the tissues. So basically we can shut down their capacity to produce toxins that destroy our tissues and lead to like zombie skin, right? So we have like the zombie skin cure in these plants. And it does so in a way that doesn't actually put that direct selective pressure on growth on the bacteria. So that's some of like, I think something that's really exciting that's starting to come out in the field is better understanding how some of these work and that they may work differently than how some of our Western medicines do.
You've researched a bit about quorum sensing in bacteria as well, mm-hmm. and that's kind of a different approach to looking at antimicrobial natural products as well. For anyone listening, do you want to describe what quorum sensing is? Because I think it's one of the coolest things with what bacteria do.
Yeah. So quorum sensing is exactly that process I was describing where you can switch off their ability to produce things that can harm the body by basically interfering with their communication system. So if you think about like a little lone bacteria, right, they're very weak when they're as a single cell. They have strength in numbers. And in fact, when they reach a certain number or certain density known as a quorum, they will start upregulating certain genes that can lead to the release of toxins that basically destroy surrounding tissues, enable them to better invade the body and also produce food for them to eat, right? So it's a way that they can get into the body better. What some of these plant compounds do is they basically interfere with that communication system such that even if you have a lot of the bacteria concentrated in one place, they can't sense each other. So you basically turn off their ability to sense one another. And as a result, they behave totally differently.
I think it's a fascinating, that it's a change in perspective to think that we're not just trying to kill the bacteria to stop their growth, but that we're really trying to enable our bodies to deal with mm-hmm. it, because we have an immune system that is meant to do that as well. And the only time that we have a problem is when our own immune system is not able to keep up with that quorum or that, you know, that,
yeah,
that over, overactivity. And it's a very interesting perspective shift away from just getting rid of the bad things. I mean, I used to be very kind of germaphobe, like fearful, I had a fear of it. And I think that perspective is valuable to change. That perspective is valuable because it's going to lead to less resistance and also more options for how to treat these infections.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, and you know, one thing that I think is really cool is that we just don't even have all the right questions right now, right? There's so many traditional medicines that are in use today that have been in use historically. There's over 33,000 plants that have been used in some form of human medicine. 33,000. I mean, scientists, just for perspective, have maybe looked at with any level of rigor and maybe a couple hundred of those. I mean, so for any of the listeners that are like, wow, I want to study pharmacognosy or learn more about medicinal plants, this is the field to go into because there's a ton of space to explore and you can really find some interesting things. And I think we just have to keep thinking about what are some new questions we can ask of these plants too.
And I think a huge limitation in natural products is what tests do we have to actually determine mm-hmm. what the activity of these plants are? Because maybe the plant has an amazing activity, as Miyabi said, maybe it activates your host immune system and can mm-hmm. help you fight off any disease in that way. But we don't always have a test to be able to determine that. And even if we have a test, is it high throughput? Can we actually put a whole plant extract library through this test? Or do we have to do one at a time, which would take forever?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, the high throughput thing is a really big question. We did some work in the past few years looking at our library or trying to trying to really hone down on certain plants for pain. And it's difficult because there aren't that many high throughput assays for pain. A lot of it involves patch clamping or whole animal assays. And you don't want to just screen a whole library against, that'd be a lot of mice, right? So having those models is really important. And that's where basic scientists, maybe scientists that have never even thought that they'd be contributing ever to like natural products research, but their work in developing new models can actually really help us advance our field.
Pain is such a multifaceted thing as well. I personally, I have chronic pain, and natural products and specifically mixtures of crude extracts work really well for me.
Oh yeah. Like, I mean, a lot of the plants that I work on, I do a lot with like I said, like in European herbalism, kind of focused in the Mediterranean basin and the Balkans and kind of North Africa, where a lot of their plants are prepared as a single species. But if you think about what happens in other parts of the world, like in traditional Chinese medicine or Ayurveda or Yunani, like all of those traditional Tibetan medicine, those all like really have numerous species that are brought together in different mixtures. And so it gets really complicated really quickly when you start mixing lots of different species, and then you're trying to sort out that chemistry. Because now instead of having thousands, you know, like 1,000 compounds in one plant tissue, you've multiplied that by several factors.
You know, in the beginning of this podcast, we talked about indigenous practices and knowledge and us kind of learning from them. But I think sometimes we take for granted the amount of safety information that we've obtained from these cultures. I mean, and just the combinations that they've discovered is absolutely amazing. Just, I always think of ayahuasca. How did they figure that out?
And that it's different, and that it can be different, and that there's very, very complicated ways that you can, you know, minutely alter the formulation that we would only begin to be able to scratch the surface, even if, and I know people are hopefully planning on looking into it, but then also on the flip side, that there's other realms of medicine that we don't understand yet that are in traditional medicine that I'm not sure can be quantified. That I think there's so much value in traditional medicine, and that the way that we've gone about with science is to try and understand it and respect it, and then also come to a place where it's like, we might not actually understand it though, ever.
Yeah. I think it's also important to recognize that not all plants and even all traditional medicines are safe for anybody to take, right? So like going back to ayahuasca, I worked with the ayahuascaro shaman in my early days in Peru, and I write about this in the book, and, you know, learning about this practice from him. And it's, I often wonder today what he would think of like the way it's been kind of brought out into more of an exploratory practice for the general public, because for him, it was a sacred ritual that he was kind of selected for as a child, you know, part of him being a practicing shaman. And like you said, though, the chemistry behind this is amazing. It's a mixture of, you know, monoamine oxidase inhibitors with DMT. And they use different sources of plants that have DMT present, you know, and bringing all those things together to yield this really powerful psychedelic experience. But you know, in his perspective, that was how he diagnosed his patients, how he determined which medicines to give them. So it was not about a journey of finding himself. It was about how he could learn from the plants, how he could speak to plants and learn how to heal more of his patients. So it's, you know, and I know when I say things like that, I've had like people comment on podcasts where I've talked about, oh, he talks to the plants. Well, like it's like, I don't mean it necessarily literally, but in some ways it's how he describes it. It's how he learns from nature, or how he learned from nature. And I have a habit of talking to plants too. I mean, when I'm out in the hikes, I don't know. It's just, for me, it's like seeing, especially species that I recognize, I just like say hello, you know, and I'll like name them. I don't know. It's just my way of connecting to the earth. So I kind of, you know, straddle this interesting domain of where, like, on one hand, I'm very much a very hardcore scientist, but I also like to talk to the flowers.
You are in good company.
Yeah. We talk to everything, things that we can't even see. Here's a quick word from our company, then back to the science.
There are a ton of choices when it comes to purchasing CBD products, and there are a ton of reasons why someone might want to try one. Some products only contain CBD, and others contain a variety of other active ingredients as well. Profound Naturals hemp smoke products are the only product that contain active ingredients created at high temperatures with the natural ratio of rare and minor cannabinoids that have been used for thousands of years. People are using these products regularly and say that they work better than other products they've tried before. Try the tincture and our topicals at www.profoundnaturals.com. Every product can be shipped to all 50 states.
So it seems like we're all in agreement that we like complex extracts, at least in some cases. But definitely what Miyabi and I have learned over the past couple years is there is a lot of challenges in receiving grant funding to study complex extracts. A lot of people call it a fishing trip because you're just kind of hoping for the best and exploring plants. So have you had any issues with receiving grant funding to study these extracts?
Yes. In fact, I had one reviewer that did call one of my early grants a fishing expedition. My response, in my head at least, is like, well, I'm fishing in a stocked pond. So, I mean, I think it has to do with a lot of dogma around this field and a lot of limitations we faced early on with our analytical capabilities, right? So if you think about the history of pharma and a lot of their natural products campaigns, because big pharma was very much into natural products, looking through these very complex extracts, especially in the 80s and early 90s, they dropped all of that in the 90s when along came a field known as combinatorial chemistry, which is basically where you put together lots of individual molecules that are man-made. And the idea was if you put enough of those together and you put them through these high throughput robotic systems that you would find new drugs like new antibiotics. It was complete failure for antibiotics, moderately successful in other fields of medicine, but antibiotics definitely didn't work. And so we lost a lot of that momentum in natural products research. And I think a lot of it's also been stymied by the fact that historically, you know, the way the system works, this magic bullet approach is that, you know, you'd be pushed to really isolate each single compound, get its structure. And when you're trying to pull out something that's maybe less than 1% of the total extract, that takes a lot of material and a lot of effort. Today, we have better techniques available. I think, you know, it's really exciting what's happening in the domains of high-resolution mass spectrometry and metabolomics. I'm really excited to see what evolves within the domain of cryo-EM micro-ED, which is a kind of combination of electron microscopy and electron diffraction that allows us to take a look at, you know, crystalline structures within microcrystals of mixtures. And so that's an area that I'm going to be diving into in my lab very soon. But yeah, it's very difficult to convince funding bodies to look at this. I think now maybe it's a little bit easier if you really push these technical platforms that are emerging, but still right. They want you to isolate the compounds.
That doesn't make any, the magic bullet approach has never really made, it makes sense in back in the simplistic days when we understood or when we had a very basic knowledge of like problem in the body, target mm-hmm. in the body, drug that hits the target, problem solved. Like, and we went crazy and we've saved many lives with all the low hanging fruit. All right. But like, they've all been taken. Like all the low hanging fruit for those medications are done. We've found them, right? I mean, and some of them, as we discussed, came with their own problems from finding them, like resistance. But this idea of the magic bullet being the solution, especially for chronic disorders, has never made any sense to me, especially because a single target with a single molecule with a complex disorder that spans multiple systems, just it's difficult. And I'm just, you know, bringing it back to cannabis. It's one of the things that I think is so amazing about cannabis and the endocannabinoid system is the reach, like the span or the reach of the amount of chemical diversity in the plant, and then the amount of reach that the endocannabinoid system has. It touches almost every single one of the other systems, probably every single one. I think to my knowledge, there's not a single pathology that exists that doesn't have a dysregulation in the endocannabinoid system. In some context of like how different parts of the body or like how it interacts. And it's never made a ton of sense to me that we want a silver bullet to solve a problem. Like I would want like a blanket, right?
Or like, yeah, I want like a multimodal approach. Cause I think that's really where traditional medicine is most successful when it's, you know, you have your pharmacological agent, in this case, a plant extract, but then there's also like a spiritual kind of human connection that's important to the healing process. And there's often lifestyle modifications. I mean, when you see a healer, they're not just giving you a plant brew to take to treat some problem. They're going to tell you, well, you need to eliminate this from your diet, or I want you to try and exercise more. I mean, it's a lot of the things that we consider to be kind of your primary care wellness physician advice, but this actually has deeper roots in the origins of medicine. It's that multiple approach. And, you know, I also deal with chronic pain. You know, I was born with multiple congenital birth defects, missing bones in my leg. I'm an amputee. I had such severe scoliosis as a kid. It was like crushing my internal organs. I had my hip rebuilt. So I'm like the $1 million woman being rebuilt orthopedically. But as I get older, you know, I kind of live with pain, and the way that I manage it is really through those multimodal approaches. It's about diet. It's about trying to, you know, have foods in my diet that are also very anti-inflammatory whenever possible, moderate exercise, you know, medicinal plants, like it's all of that together. Whereas when I go to see a pain doctor, if they just want to give me, you know, a painkiller or something that's going to really, I can't function under, like, so I can't take those drugs because it's just, maybe I'm a very high strung individual, but I need a little bit of pain to like work. So
food is medicine. We talk about medicinal plants often, and people are thinking about these plants that are, you know, only found in the Amazon and have these amazing drug-like benefits. But using a diversity of herbs, even, and reducing the amount of inflammatory foods, increasing the number of anti-inflammatory foods, etc., this can all be helpful. And, you know, I talk about rosemary a lot. It's one of my favorite medicinal plants ever, because when I was studying this medicinal plant extract library in graduate school, rosemary was active in almost every assay that we tested it on. And that really kind of shifted my perspective. And, you know, I think part of the issues with using either drugs or supplements that are in capsules that are available at Walmart or whatever, they are too easy to take. We don't need to adjust our lives at all to utilize them. We simply take a pill with our coffee and hope it's life altering. But as you're saying, Dr. Quave, it's so much more than that. And health and well-being are so much more complicated than that. It could even be as complicated as changing the people around you that are causing you stress and different mental health issues. And that could improve your mental health, which will improve your general health if you are able to change that.
Completely agree. And it's how I feel as well, is that our lives and this journey of our life is about this experience, and that pieces of that experience are going to be painful, and that pieces of that experience are going to be difficult, and that the goal is not to like eliminate that pain. The goal is not to, you know, be totally fine, whatever that means. I don't know if anyone is. The goal is to like balance, like what you said in the very, very beginning. The goal is to be at balance and to find the things that increase your quality of life so that you can function and so that you can do the things you can do. And that a piece of that comes from this like incredible amount of like self-care and self like realization and evaluation. Like, I am very stringent with my diet as well, and it can be exhausting. And but it goes into everything. And going back to grant funding, good luck trying to fund a grant. We're talking about being like, I mean, because like one of the things Riley and I talk about all the time is intention, is the intention of your use with cannabis, and people asking us all the time about tolerance breaks and all the time about like, if you're a daily user. Both of us are daily users, but we don't take tolerance breaks. We don't have to, but it's because it has to do with this like intention of your use and the moderation and the quality of your life. And I mean, I just could only imagine what people's response would be if I wanted to try and quantify that, you know, to try to put a scientific quantification on the value of what you prioritize in your life and how you view your life and your relationship with that medicine, because we just don't teach about it right now. Like right now we teach like, take this.
Well, I think part of it's our culture doesn't value quality of life. The American culture does not value quality of life, period. I mean, you can travel to different parts of the world and you can experience what it's like to have value around quality of life. It's not about number of dollars that you have in your bank account. It's about that overall quality. And I don't know that you can fix that within, like, on a cultural level. Maybe just move to another place. I mean, I'm already plotting my retirement in Italy because I've always experienced a very good quality of life there. And my husband's from there. And I'm just like, my vision of like good quality of life will be me with like a place to write and having a nice garden with some plants that I can, you know, grow and consume and herbs I can grow. I mean, it's so I guess quality of life also depends person to person, like what really makes you happy. Yeah.
I also think as scientists, people expect us to have a really bad quality of life. Like,
yeah.
Like the amount of times, the amount of times people have reached out to me and they're like, oh, I'll call you on Saturday. You work on Saturdays, right? And I'm like, absolutely not. Please don't call me on a Saturday.
It is the truth for so many people in science, though. Like, I mean, that's a challenge when you're trying to like work as a scientist, because you have to draw that line, that boundary, especially when you've got family. It's like, I used to be one of those people that worked like every day, like including weekends. And I finally got to a point where I had to stop.
Like, well, and it's kind of the infrastructure, at least as like a graduate student, or well, you're in grad school. I mean, you have cell culture that rely on you to give it more food like every day or every other day. So you can't take a full weekend off. You need to go into the lab. You need to feed those cells. You need to prep stuff for Monday. And it's just kind of, it's fun for a certain amount of time, but burnout is, it's huge. Going to happen if you keep doing that for 10 years.
Yeah.
We'll put that in our grant. We'll put that in our grant, our next grant application. We prioritize quality of life. Yeah. So another question I had, if you want to talk about it, is you have experience both in academia and in the industry. And I was wondering if you wanted to talk about the differences in the way that it's received. Both of us come from academic backgrounds, now are in the industry, and it's very different. It's a very different experience. In addition to that, like science, whether you do the same scientific experiment is looked at very different if it comes from industry versus academia. And I was just wondering what your thoughts are on that.
Yeah. So, I mean, I've definitely written grants for both academia and industry with my startup. It's, I guess it depends on like what side of industry you're in. If you're in kind of that early discovery space, I don't think it's that much different from an academic lab. I think when it's more, when you're actually producing products, and you have a commercialization, kind of active commercialization activity, it may be a little bit different.
We've had a little bit of trouble because a lot of what we do on social media is we try to get data from people. We know that the reach from social media is greater than almost any other way of obtaining data. So we ask questions from our audiences, they respond to them, we write them up and graph them, et cetera.
Awesome.
Well, you would think.
We have this large reach. And so we have like together, both of us, because of our social media accounts, have like larger population bases for a lot of the questions of cannabis than that have been published before, which is incredible. And we're really excited about it. Like, we know that 20% of people can't feel edibles. And that actually.
Wow. That's amazing. Yeah.
And it was reproduced across different social media platforms, which is also very cool. And across, we have slightly different reaches. Like, and I think it's fascinating. We did like Instagram, TikTok, and Reddit, and it all came back pretty much identical.
Here's the secret. Whoever's reviewing this, if it's a paper grant, probably has no experience with any of those platforms. I think that's part of the problem, right? It's like if they don't understand the platforms, how are they going to really review it with fairness?
It's like, so this is exactly the issue we're dealing with, is a bias against TikTok. And I understand that TikTok has a little bit of a bad reputation or a reputation of just being, you know, geared towards 15-year-olds. But essentially, we wrote up a paper with data from TikTok users. And one of the reviewers said that this data like wasn't good enough because it was gathered on TikTok, and that instead we should try Facebook or Twitter. to get data from. And I'm like,
that's in your rebuttal where you like show the numbers, like actually there are this many people that engage with this platform. There's just this platform. Yeah. It's that's the thing that gets tiresome about like working in the field that not a lot of other people work in, is you have to spend a lot of your grant educating them on like, why is the complexity of a plant actually something important to study, or why is this source of data a relevant source? Like, yeah, there's a lot of education you have to put into like basically teaching them, yes, this is important.
And the cannabis space is an interesting one because since, you know, in the last 10 years, there's been exponentially more research on cannabis, which is amazing and so, so awesome. But there's a large percentage of people who lean more towards that pharmaceutical magic bullet approach to cannabis, right? And I think that in some regards, we're facing that as well because we do not believe that that's the value of the plant, or that that's the whole value of the plant. And also for cannabis specifically, there's just thousands of years of evidence of, you know, strain specificity and like different experience that people.
And having those different compounds present can actually help protect you from some of the adverse effects that people feel from using cannabis. Like if you have CBD present with your THC, you're not going to have as bad of anxiety or some of these other effects people don't really like from THC, and that CBD can protect yourself from those feelings.
Yeah. I mean, it's interesting that, you know, all I know is like today's cannabis is not the cannabis our grandparents smoked. It's like these, the number of different, you know, strains that have been developed and all the different products that are available today. I mean, yeah, I think it's really important to educate yourselves on for all listeners, educate yourselves on the pros and cons of different, you know, constituents. And I tend to lean towards the more complex plant.
Such a good point about how much the plant has changed. A large portion of that too has to do, we talk a lot about THC percentages and how most people, because it is expensive, and I understand this, when you go to a store, they want to get the thing that has the highest THC percentage because you think that that's like the most bang for your buck or the best quality product. And I just think it's a detriment. And I know that having the percentage there is useful. And I understand why it's very, very helpful to have that quantification. But I completely agree that the more complex, and I mean, we talk about this all the time with our research, or that the more complex mixtures tend to be a better experience. And
yeah,
and people who are even saying, you know, people who disagree with that, I think just haven't tried it.
Or maybe they think that they have to smoke it, and a lot of people don't want to smoke in general. So maybe they switch to something like edibles that are made with distillate often, because it, you know, looks like a safer way to take a product, but realistically it's just a bunch of THC and sugar, and that might not interact with your body that well. And there are other ways to use flower without smoking if you don't want to smoke. You know, there are dryer vaporizers. You could make your own extract if you wanted to do that with just alcohol. I mean, you could use just vodka and make your own tincture. There's definitely options.
I think that the main problem that the rare cannabinoid and just in general, the more complex like chemodiversity aspect of cannabis is having is this education barrier where actually, as Riley mentioned, TikTok is a young app. And that is something that I've been, you know, we've talked about it before, about how both of us do basically drug education on an app that is for people who are younger. But both of us also fundamentally believe like we would have benefited from, you know,
yeah,
learning at an earlier age. And I think it's like, this is something that's just a, it's a barrier that I really hope that scientists, like we can all help to move forward in the future, that, you know, like people have access to more information. And like, who are scientists? I didn't even know who, like what a scientist was. I knew the idea of it, but like, not a real scientist. Like, you know, what is the day to day?
Absolutely. Yeah. I love that you guys are doing this. I love that like you're so engaged in TikTok, and I've been watching your videos. It's like, it's my lab, you know, my lab always stays young because they're all college students, right? As I get older, and they convinced me recently to start like a lab TikTok account, and I'm dipping my toes in, you know, a little bit at a time, but it's been a lot of fun. And it's really interesting to me what content people engage with. Like, we had one post on like just just defining what is a biosafety level and like what the different levels mean. And it got so much engagement. And I was like, wow, people are really curious about this. I would have never thought that was such a point of curiosity, you know, but it is. And so I'm interested in seeing what else we can share on that platform, because I think, you know, there's so much misinformation about herbs out there and about medicinal plants, especially during times of health crises. You know, with COVID, there was so much misinformation about, you know, cures for COVID from deadly poisonous plants. Like, please, no, don't eat this poisonous plant, you know? And so I think it's a great platform to really get out there and help communicate that knowledge in a way that's accessible, because you're right. There are some people that will totally watch a TikTok that would maybe never read a piece that I could write in a magazine somewhere, right? So it's a way of ensuring to reaching more people.
And with cannabis education or any type of drug education, you're not just teaching about that drug. You're teaching chemistry and pharmacology. You're trying to make it fun for people. And if we go back to the COVID, what we were just talking about, and the different studies that were conducted with cannabis and the SARS-CoV-2 virus, you really have to get into the details of the chemistry and biology to understand the very important nuances in these papers. For instance, one of the papers was discussing how CBDA, the acidic form of that molecule, was effective at preventing this infection. But it was quickly misconstrued that CBD was helping prevent COVID infections. And then from there, smoking weed prevents you from getting COVID. And it's like, whoa, there's this very important distinction. We need to know that CBDA is the precursor molecule to CBD. It contains an extra carboxylic acid, and it's not very active in the body. When we take it in products, when we take products that contain CBD, they typically don't contain CBDA because it's less active. So when we smoke bud that contains CBDA, it is converted to CBD. So you're not actually taking in that CBDA. But this is very difficult to convey across a, you know, 30-second TikTok or something that's so short.
Yeah, for sure. I'm just like, I could just imagine like.
But yeah, so thank you so much for being on here. Do you want to talk about your current work? Like, what are you currently working on or anything, or like where people can find you? Actually, we will drop all of those links too in the
description. Yeah. So in my group, as I said, like, we're really interested in infectious disease. We're doing work on a number of different targets. So we've got a COVID project going. We have a project on the super fungus Candida auris that one of my students is working on. We're doing some stuff on like metabolism of different herbs. But like I said, we're getting into this new chemistry platform to try and really start looking at the microcrystalline compositions of these complex mixtures. And then I'm also finally getting back into the field. I spent all day like trying to sort out very complicated travel arrangements for an expedition in Albania and Kosovo this summer. So I'm going to be getting back in the field. So folks, if you want to like follow us in the field, I have accounts on Twitter and Instagram under Quave Ethnobot. And if you want to read more about what it's been like to become a scientist that studies plants that are used in traditional medicine, you can check out my book. It's called The Plant Hunter. It was published just last year, and it's in hardback right now. We have a really fun paperback version of it coming out in June. So that's where they can find me. Oh, and also my podcast, Foodie Pharmacology, where I talk about food and medicine and interview lots of really cool scientists.
Just a note about your book, because I did read it. It's amazing. I thought you were cool before, but after I read that book, I was like, wow, she's really, really cool. So I'm glad you're on the podcast, because that book is very inspiring. And if you want to know more about natural product chemistry and ethnobotany, it's a really, really good place to start.
So some other exciting things that we have coming up is I'm a member of the Society for Economic Botany, and we have our meeting this June in Jamaica, and early registration is coming up soon, but you can still register, I think, all the way up until May. And this is a place where you can meet lots of ethnobotanists that get together that work on plants from all over the world. And next year, it's actually going to be hosted here in Atlanta at Emory. I'll be hosting the joint meeting of the Society for Economic Botany and the Society of Ethnobiology. And we are very welcoming to people of all levels of interest with herbs, you know, students, you know, herbalists, scientists, the whole gang. So keep an eye out for that.
Well, again, thank you so much for being on the podcast, Dr. Quave. We definitely all learned a lot from you. We will tag all your information in the description of this episode. And to our sesh mates, we will catch you on the next episode of Smoking Science.